good evening to Europe, good morning to Asia, and good afternoon to those all across the fruited plains. You're now locked into the worldwide 20 megabit beacon of truth, hope, and justice, otherwise known as your weekly dose of the Crimson Pill. I, your host, the great and all-powerful Antonin Fiori, just make sure you don't peek behind the curtain, folks, encourage you to unfasten your seatbelts and turn on all portable electronic devices as we embark on the next voyage of the USS Crimson Pill. Our course has been charted for the Isle of Light by way of the Straits of Knowledge and the Sea of Tranquility. In the event of turbulence, the captain reminds you that your seat cushion is no substitute for an open mind. If you're seated in an exit row, you are now invited to move forward to our first-class cabin of truth at any time. Ladies and gentlemen of the listening audience, welcome to the Crimson Pill. Ladies and gentlemen of the listening audience, welcome to BBSRadio.com and the Crimson Pill Radio Program with your host, Antonin Fiori. Today, Sunday, the 19th of June of 2011, the Crimson Pill is launched from somewhere warm and between the coasts. Your humble host, in pursuit of truth and light, has recently traveled from the east to the west to receive knowledge, and today is in the midst of a journey from the west to the east to uncover clarity and light. The journey is a difficult one, yet made earnestly and with great haste for you, the listening audience. Today's program features our guest, Dr. Joseph Farrell, whose work is extensive and fascinating. We pre-recorded this interview on Thursday of this week to accommodate Dr. Farrell's busy schedule, and so here just shortly we'll begin playing for you our recorded interview. I apologize that we don't have time in the program to entertain your calls, but Dr. Farrell has graciously agreed to join us in a future program in the live format so that we will have that opportunity for you, the listening audience, to engage and ask your questions directly to Dr. Farrell. As the interview begins, we will have a bit of an introduction for Dr. Farrell and his work. And so before I leave the program to continue my journeys, I would just like to pose these two very important considerations for you. First, in our interview, we'll be discussing what people would consider to be Nazi-era, World War II-era Germany. And a number of folks believe that they know maybe a fair amount about World War II and the events, the political events and happenings in Europe from that era. And you know quite a few of those things quite well, from schooling, from history, et cetera. But there are some interesting things, fascinating things, that maybe you have not encountered with it, and that will be the focus of our interview with Dr. Farrell. The key consideration, why did Nazi Germany call themselves the Third Reich? Now, we've all heard that term, but very few of us know what that means, the Third Reich. Well, Reich means empire, ladies and gentlemen. And so why did Adolf Hitler call that empire the Third Empire? Why indeed? What does that really mean? Your humble host could tell you just now, but listen to the interview instead. And then afterward, be sure you research the topic for yourself. Let's understand why they deemed themselves to be the Third Reich. One last closing thought before we begin the interview. All of the work of the Crimson Pill follows a thread, a storyline. These interviews, these topics, at first might seem to be discrete from one another. Please understand, they're all part of a continuing storyline. Step by step, piece by piece, we are assembling the fragments of the truth. Some of them lost, some now recovered. Ladies and gentlemen, the Crimson Pill is at your service to reassemble the truth. And now, we turn to our interview with Dr. Farrell. Please tune in next week. We'll see you again with another fascinating interview and a gracious guest. Ladies and gentlemen, our interview with Dr. Joseph Farrell.
Ladies and gentlemen of the Crimson Pill listening audience, it is my distinct pleasure to welcome to the program today Dr. Joseph Farrell. Dr. Farrell's work has been, to say the very least, wide-ranging. Oftentimes when you visit with someone who is a subject matter authority, perhaps from the body of their academic background and research, all too often you find that there's an intense specialization into relatively, you know, limited time frames or periods of history. In the case of Dr. Joseph Farrell, I guess you could say that his specialization in a range of historical sense is all of it, because the body of his work includes inquiries that go back so far. And to be quite frank, the implications of some of his findings are things that affect us quite far into the future. I'm going to stop short with trying to make my introduction for you, Dr. Farrell. At this point, I would just like to say thank you so much for your time to be here. Welcome to the Crimson Pill program. And how are you, sir?
Fine, Antonin. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate the introduction and the opportunity.
Well, you know, when you give this sort of introduction for the average type researcher, it's fairly cut and dry. But, you know, Dr. Farrell, as I said, the range of your work is quite spectacular in the scope of history, of cultures, of theology, of technology, and that's why it is such an honor for me to have you with the program today. I wonder, sir, for those of us in our listening audience who may not yet be very familiar with your work, could you sort of give us the type of introduction that you might make when you're, you know, giving a presentation or something of that effect to help describe the body of your career's work?
Well, it's kind of difficult to describe, and when I'm speaking publicly, I usually just dive right in. attempt to summarize it, but I guess what my work is really about is about what I call alternative science or hidden science or things of that sort. And by science, I would suggest that my major focus has been on physics, although I'm certainly concerned with other sciences like biology or sociology, so on and so forth. But
sure.
My major focus has been on physics. And using that, I use it as a foil, as a template, so to speak, to examine ancient myths and to examine modern historical happenings that, to my mind, don't make much sense. So if you look at the body of my work, say, in the last 11 years, what it really is, it's about the interface between history, culture, and science. And that really is it. That really is it in a nutshell.
Sure. Sure. And I'd like to kind of describe for the listening audience And please jump in and help me you know, make any corrections along the way. But I kind of view your work in almost three stages.
Mm-hmm.
The first stage, you know, circa 2000 to 2005, some of your works included the Giza Death Star book, the Giza Death Star Deployed, and then the physics, and then also the Cosmic War. Mm-hmm. And then there's kind of the middle phase, 2005 to 2010, where a lot of your work was directed toward an exploration and investigation into the time period in and around 1920 through 1945 in Germany, some of the technology, the physics research, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And then your more recent work, which maybe we can try to come back to that a bit later in the program. But
sure.
How would you amend what I've sort of described here, just briefly?
Well, I think that's an excellent way to describe it. My only amendation would be to say that when I started writing these things, I write with a kind of a preconceived plan. In other words, I project three or four books in advance of the books that I'm even actually writing.
Oh, interesting.
So
interesting.
When I started writing the Giza Death Star series, you'll note that the order of the books that that were published, Reich of the Black Sun, which was the first book on World War II Nazi technology, that came out in between Giza Death Star Deployed and Giza Death Star Destroyed. Mm-hmm. And that was very deliberate. And it has been a deliberate plan or architecture that I've been following with these books, because they do all dovetail into each other quite deliberately, and I try to connect the dots as best as I can between the books for readers that have been following them all. But
I think you do so very effectively, by the way.
Well, thank you. But you are quite correct. I've been following a kind of a two-track approach to this, dealing with very ancient history and what I think are the implied technologies and physics in some ancient texts. And of course, I understand and I admit that it's a very speculative case that I'm making. And then more recent history, particularly focused on the Nazis. And the reason why the Nazis enter this story is, of course, because they were acutely interested in these ancient mythologies and for the potentialities of a technology and a science that they contained.
Quite right,
so that's
yes.
That's really why they fit into this huge architecture that I've been writing about. So yeah, the books are kind of laid out according to a preconceived plan, and I've been following it rather rigorously. It may look to be haphazard, but I think for the readers that get into the books, they'll see how they all kind of tie together.
Oh, I can definitely provide a personal testimony to that fact. I've followed everything right along until just your most recent release, which I haven't had a chance to get to yet, but I'm sure that when I do, it's going to be just like the other work beforehand, where I'm just compelled to read until I finish. It's just fascinating. I think what I appreciate most about your style is that in a field where there are so many researchers who... Mm. They seem to be unable to avoid the temptation of becoming sensationalistic or mm-hmm. you know, provocative with their approach. I find that you speak with a voice of reason, of clarity, a rigorously applied methodology with the research and documentation. And,
well, thank you.
Well, it just seems to represent, you know, for those who have not, for some reason, whatever that might be, not become familiar with your work yet, they definitely need to get in there. So what I had hoped to do with our interview today is really focus mm-hmm. on sort of that middle period, beginning with the Reich of the Black mm-hmm. Sun and
right.
your works in that line. And Dr. Farrell, what I've found, I like to, each time we bring up subject matter, when it's not in and around our immediate events or timeline, mm-hmm. I always like to try to throw a few thoughts out there that get people's minds clicking right up front.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, I think many Americans, when they hear World War II come up, they have a flashback to junior high history class and to a few of them, and they'd like to partition their mind away and think of that as ancient history. And I think they miss the pervasive connections, implications, mm-hmm. ramifications of what that time period didn't just mean then, what it means today.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be talking, I'm very sure, through the course of our conversation about the SS, for example, which mm-hmm. many of the listeners, you know, have some context for what the SS was or, you know, meant as a part of Nazi Germany. In my research, I found that in 1945, the size, the scale, or the scope of the SS had reached 1.25 million, 1,250,000.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a little more research to try to provide some context for our listeners. If we take, from today's estimates, all of the employees of General Electric, plus GM, plus Ford, let's throw in all of the employees of the FBI and the CIA,
mm-hmm.
let's throw in all the employees of Microsoft and Apple,
mm-hmm.
and we're still not there yet. That gets us to 925,000. So when we add in IBM, that puts us over the top, 1.35
right.
million.
Right.
That's an awful lot of boots on the ground and a lot
yes,
of resources going to tap. How about if we turn you loose there?
Well, you're quite right to point out that the SS was not only an elite organization, but it was very large. And the other thing that I would add to your remarks is that Your analogy not only to the CIA, in other words, to an intelligence agency of the government, of the federal government, is correct, because the German Reich was like this country, was a federated state, and the SS was definitely an agency of its intelligence organs, and in fact it was the largest. The Reichssicherheit Hauptamt was beyond all other German intelligence agencies, quite definitely the largest and quite thoroughly SS. So that analogy is correct. The other analogy that you're drawing there is to a large and, for all intents and purposes, multinational corporation. And this, too, is quite correct, at least insofar as the SS had its own private economy. It was quite literally not only a state within a state, but it was also an economy within an economy. It was it was a huge part of the German war machine, and it was plugged very directly into the other major facets of the Nazi war economy, like IG Farben and ThyssenKrupp and all of those very, very large German corporations. And we have to understand something else, and you bring up yet another analogy, or imply another analogy about the SS, and this is precisely the fact that it was so large that the idea that it simply ceased to exist on May 1st, 1945, with the assumption of Grand Admiral Raeder, Grand Admiral Dönitz to the leadership of the Third Reich, and then the subsequent surrender a week later. The idea that this organization simply ceased to exist with all of its vast financial resources, all of its deep, deep penetrations into not only German intelligence, but the intelligence structure of post-war Europe, and the idea that it simply ceased to exist with all of its financial resources, which were truly, truly mind-boggling. I mean, we have to remember, and I point this out in a book that I wrote in 2008 called The Nazi International, that IG Farben alone was such a huge, gigantic multinational company. I mean, it was really, truly the first gargantuanly sized multinational company in history. Well, it was only finally liquidated in the year 2003. You know, in other words, it was so huge it took that long to sort out all the tangle of overlapping license agreements and patent arrangements and so on and so forth that IG Farben controlled. So the idea that the SS as an organization, and therefore the idea that the Nazi Party or its ideology simply ceased to function on May 7th, 1945. It's just sort of stupid when you get right down to it.
You're exactly right. And, you know, when I encounter folks who have not yet had a chance to really dive into your work in any depth, the way that I try to build their intrigue, to compel them to dive in, is by creating a sort of another analogy, comparing it to today. I use examples of, let's say, for example, that China or Russia, some entity, made a swift and concerted attack on the United States, and somehow, although this seems far-fetched, but somehow their position and their advantage was significant enough that the United States were to declare military defeat. So as a nation...
Right.
And yet, most Americans are pretty quick to realize that even if that were to happen, probably several branches of the military itself, let alone our intelligence community, the NSA, the CIA, the FBI, all of these would have plans well in advance of that moment of defeat or surrender to go underground and continue the resistance, so to speak, into the future. And that's only just our recognized agencies. We also know that even our civilian base, there'd be large, groupings of people who also would try to take that resistance underground. And so it might seem provocative on the surface to consider the question, what if the West, the Allied powers, really did not win outright World War II? It might seem provocative on the surface, but it's really not a sensationalistic question, is it?
No, it isn't, and this really is the argument that I've been trying to pursue, the overall argument that I've been trying to pursue in those Nazi books, because you're precisely correct. And as I point out in the Nazi International, and many other authors have pointed this out as well, the Nazis did have several strategic evacuation and post-war plans. The unfortunate thing is that Allied historians tend to think that because they found this or that particular plan or closed down this or that particular Nazi front, that they were successful in shutting the entire thing down. Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't take you very long to investigate certain goings-on in Latin America to, conclude that this is about the farthest thing from the truth that there is. The post-war plans of the Nazis were very ingenious, and they were executed with typical German efficiency. And they succeeded, in my opinion, in creating the infrastructure of a post-war international organization, a kind of, I like to call it an extraterritorial state, Antonin, because that I think is effectively what the post-war allies were dealing with. They were dealing with a multi-headed hydra whose presence was everywhere and whose center was nowhere. In other words, they were dealing with something that they couldn't eradicate. It became, as you so aptly observed, it became an underground organization. Mm. And to a certain extent, it kind of closed the historical circle, because if you look back at some of the origins of the Nazi Party itself, that party was to a certain extent midwifed into existence by underground organizations, by secret societies and occult organizations. So in a certain sense, it returned to its roots after the war. It went back underground.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Now, you know, where you have arrived at this moment is a thread that what I'd like to do is in our conversation come back to that point, that moment in history, and follow that thread. But what I find most intriguing about your work, Dr. Farrell, is that, you know, the geopolitical machinations of man's inhumanity to man is more so, in my view, a kind of a byproduct of your work. It seems to me that your work begins, its origin points begin from the technologies, from the sciences.
Yes.
And that's what I very much appreciate about also your work in this period, beginning with Reich of the Black Sun. And I want to throw out for the listening audience, here's another kind of a mind experiment or a thought experiment. What I'm really trying to do is get your attention, folks, and help you to realize how significant this is. I think a lot of Americans, if they were posed with the question, who was the most important scientist of the 20th century, probably, I would guess most Americans would probably either land on the name of Albert Einstein or maybe even Stephen Hawking, since he's contemporary.
Right.
And yet, when you ask the average person, when was the theory of relativity produced, they don't realize that it's already more than 100 years ago, and that Albert Einstein, he wasn't the only smart guy walking around in his day, was he?
Oh, no, by no means. And you're quite right to point out that Einstein has become more or less the icon of contemporary physics. And, in fact, there are physicists that will quite boldly come out, although they're certainly in the minority, but there are physicists that will quite boldly come out and say that that's precisely the problem, because it's been more or less of a dead end. And what I try to pursue, Antonin, in the Nazi series of books is the idea that Nazi Germany, in throwing off the relativistic paradigm, well, the way that most academics interpret that is that Nazi Germany locked itself into a cul-de-sac from which it could not escape, and that's the reason they lost the race for the bomb, that's the reason that they lost the war, and so on and so forth. But the actual historical record, when you look at all of the achievements of Nazi Germany, and let's understand here, you know, Germany at that time was a nation about the size of the state of Texas.
Okay.
So in other words, you are looking at a technological explosion during the 12-year existence of the Third Reich that really is without parallel in human history. And I think part of the answer to that lies in the fact that, yes, Nazi Germany threw off the standard paradigm of the physics of the day, and that meant, inevitably, that they were going to have far more failures than they were going to have successes. But it also meant that they did not lock themselves into a box and more or less were forced to think outside of the box, not only in terms of their theorizing, but in terms of their engineering of the theories that they were coming up with. So by the same token, while they had some stunning and colossal failures, I do mean that in the fullest sense of the word, while they had some stunning and colossal failures of the scientific mind and method, by the same token, if you read certain reports and certain documents that I produce in that Nazi series, they also had some tremendous and brilliant successes that, for the most part, have been kept more or less out of the public eye ever since.
Precisely.
And that's the scary part of it, because that in turn, as you aver, that in turn means that this technological goldmine that the Third Reich represented also represented not only the largest technology transfer in history from Germany to the Allies after the end of the war, it also represented, if you grant the proposition that there is a post-war Nazi organization that is, for all intents and purposes, extraterritorial, and that it has huge financial resources, which it did, and also had maintained its control over some of that technology and over the scientists producing it, then yes, you have a real geopolitical problem.
Absolutely. In fact, that's probably still in the realm of understatement, I think, even perhaps.
Yes, I think so.
Now, you know, I wondered if we could spend our next moment or the thread of the conversation kind of talking a little bit about some of this, the physics that you've made reference mm-hmm. to and the research mm-hmm. at the time. In part of my homework, you know, I've reviewed the work of Einstein, and over the last couple of years, I've been surprised to find how many people out there actually feel like, and, you know, a lot of the significant parts of his work and the general theory of relativity was largely borrowed from others. Now, I don't want to get into mm-hmm. that debate about, you know, if he was a plagiarist or not, but mm-hmm. some very significant names of physics that our listening audience, if you're there to take notes, folks, search the name Max Born. Have a look at mm-hmm. Niels Bohr, Werner Heisenberg, Erwin Schrödinger. Have a look at Hendrik Lorentz, Walter Kaufmann, mm-hmm. Max Planck, mm-hmm. a Frenchman that maybe you can help me with his name, the pronunciation of his last name, Henri Poincaré, or Poincaré?
Poincaré, uh-huh.
Poincaré, mm-hmm. thank you. Who is noted to have done really the heavy lifting, the hard math, so to speak, with
yes.
Some of the aspects of the theory of relativity prior to Einstein. There's David Hilbert, Paul Gerber, Ernst Gerich. And yet, these names that are easily found or the body of their research is easily obtained or learned, there were also some very significant, brilliant, gifted physicists that were a part of Nazi Germany's research program that we don't necessarily know their name on any level as recognizably as we know Einstein, for example. Is that right?
Right. Well, this really is the thorny issue, is to try to so to speak, reverse engineer exactly what Nazi physicists and scientists and engineers were up to. And that's really been more or less one of the major emphases of my work in this whole thing. But to try and summarize it or boil it all down, I think you have to go back to the interwar period. After the publication of the theory of general relativity in 1916, it was at that juncture that physicists and mathematicians and even engineers, and this is an important point that I'll get back to, that they began to look at how they could theoretically unify, or in other words, come up with a mathematical model to couple the forces of gravity and electromagnetism into one coherent mathematical expression. And at that juncture, there began, of course, the interwar speculations and papers on unified field theory, beginning with Theodor Eduard Kaluza in Germany, mm-hmm. who published the first real mathematical study of a higher dimensional unified field theory. Now, this is a very important point, because Albert Einstein himself originally did not allow that paper to be published, but eventually allowed it to be published in 1922 because he found the idea, the mathematical idea involved in the theory, to be quite fascinating. And he began to pursue, of course, for the rest of his life, similar strategies toward the unification of gravity and electromagnetism. So there were a number of papers that came out in the interwar period, most of them, incidentally, in Germany. And this is a crucial, important point that I'll get back to in just a moment. The other thing that we have to take cognizance of is that these theories were not being done, contrary to the views that are presented in most modern physics popularizations of this period. I'm thinking of a very well-known, famous theoretical physicist whose name I won't mention, but who's always on television and on radio talking about this period and mentioning these names. But the name that he never mentions is the name of a Hungarian engineer, an electrical engineer, by the name of Gabriel Krohn. And I write about this man in my book called Secrets of the Unified Field.
Yes.
Because Gabriel Krohn was also himself very thoroughly familiar with the mathematics that was being used to express these unified field theories. Well, Krohn, as an electrical engineer, had been noticing anomalies in large networked rotating electrical systems, and he published a paper in 1935 that won him the Montefiore Prize at the University of Liège in Belgium. And what he said in that paper, and I hope people will listen very carefully now, what he said in that paper was effectively that these unified field theories, which were being done in more than four spatial dimensions, that's an important point, were the very theories that engineers, electrical engineers, could use to explain those anomalies. Now, if you stop and think about what he has just said, he's just told you that with 1935 technology, that you could engineer the fabric of space-time locally.
Indeed.
Now, that's a whopper,
yes.
Because once you've said that, then that means, theoretically, you have the potential to make a weapon that could make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker.
Oh, my.
Oh, my, indeed.
Yes.
Now, what I find very interesting is that at this precise moment in Nazi Germany, all publication on the subject of unified field theories stops. In other words, they're watching and they're listening. And forget about this idea about Nazi Germany prohibiting so-called Jewish physics and not being willing to pursue some of these ideas. Because if you look at what I think to be the physics that is behind what I view as their most sensational wartime secret weapons project, a device called the Bell, this is precisely what they were after with this device. They were after a technology that could quite literally engineer the fabric of space-time locally. Now let's stop and consider what that means, the implications of what that means. Because if you've got your hands on such a technology, you've got a gateway, you've got a door to three potential uses. The first is you've got a technology that can tap into the energy of the zero-point energy, as physicists like to call it now. And that means that you would have nearly inexhaustible energy, and you would no longer be dependent upon petroleum as an energy source. Would that be of interest to Nazi Germany? Well, of course it would, because Germany, of course, is certainly one of the most petroleum-poor countries in the world, and yet it's one of those countries with a huge industrial base, and it needs lots of energy. So do we find the Germans doing this? Well, as a matter of fact, going back to the SS, absolutely, because they set up a whole department of the SS called Entwicklungsstelle 4, or Development Area 4, whose whole mission brief was to do what? It was to make Nazi Germany energy independent and to do investigation precisely of all these types of free energy or zero-point energy areas. That was its brief. So in other words, you have a technologically sophisticated great power in the 1930s committing serious resources to doing stuff that we're only talking about openly toward the end of the last century and the beginning of this one.
Yes.
The second implication that this ability to engineer the fabric of space-time would give you would be obviously a field propulsion, or if you will, an anti-gravity technology. And that, again, in terms of Nazi ideology, would give you a tremendous advantage over potential enemies.
Absolutely.
And then the third use for such a technology was, as I said, if you weaponize this stuff, you would have theoretically a potential weapon that could make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker. And this is exactly, in my opinion, what you see Nazi Germany doing. The reason why their atomic bomb program was not classified as at the highest level was precisely because they were going after this. And, you know, I take great pains, Antonin, throughout my books to point out that the atom bomb technology that they did possess, most likely they brokered an arrangement or a deal with the United States to give that to us.
Yes.
But they kept their hands on this stuff. That's the frightening conclusion that I've come to.
Indeed, indeed. Oh my, Dr. Farrell, there are about 40 different threads of questions and information I would love to be able to engage in simultaneously at this moment from what the stage that you've set thus far. But what I'd like to do, we'll take just a short commercial break here in a moment, and just in case there's anyone in the listening audience that is not adequately riveted to your seat, on the edge of your chair, in fact, at this stage, let me come at this with another set of context, another kind of a thought experiment, if you will. I have this kind of this strange fascination with asking people questions. If I'm at the grocery store, meet someone on the street, I'll pause momentarily, kind of let them know that I do some radio work, and I like to kind of figure out what people see and how they see the world and history by way of helping me phrase and build my questions for interview. And over the last few weeks, I've been asking quite a few people at random if they think turn their thoughts back to World War II and what they learned in high school and college from history about World War II, the details of the conflict, and in particular, casualties from World War II. I've posed this question quite a few times in the last few weeks. You know, what do you think was the sum total of casualties from World War II, both civilian and military combined? And the closest answer that I've received from all these folks, I bet it's probably more than 30 or maybe even 40 people just in the last few weeks, the closest answer I've gotten has been about 5 million. That's a little off, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a little off.
it's been my common experience, and in fact, the lower end of the range of responses that I've received has been 25,000 to 50,000, and that's way off.
Oh my word!
Yeah. Now the reason I bring this up is because, you know, I find that sometimes through the course of time, and as those sands of the hourglass slip through our palms. Once again, we all too frequently create a partition in our head where we think of something as ancient history. This doesn't affect me, so I don't need to know. And yet sometimes I find that certain shocks to the system can help open a realization. By more current estimates, and I know that this is an evolving process because we continue to find more information from the Soviet Union or Russia today and those former Eastern Bloc nations, they reveal more and more of the truth about what their true civilian, in particular, casualties were from the conflict. But could you, Dr. Farrell, just before we take our break, could you help our listening audience have a more truer sense of the scope and scale?
Well, yeah, World War II was just absolutely it was truly a global conflict, and most of the casualties of the war were from the European theater. But the final official count, the history book figure that I grew up learning was about 50 million people.
Yes, that's 50 million.
That's 50,000,000, 50
yes,
million.
Sir. Yes.
Now, half of those casualties were inflicted by Nazi Germany on the Soviet Union. In other words, 25 million of those casualties are Russian.
Yes. Yes.
Now, this means, folks, that World War II, like it or not, you can talk about the tremendous bravery and military commitment that the United Kingdom, the United States, France and the other smaller allies made to the war. But the fact of the matter is that every other theater of the war and every other aspect of the war is dwarfed by the sheer scale and size of operations taking place between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union. Everything else is, and I don't want my next expression to be mistaken or misunderstood as belittling or denigrating those other theaters of the war, nor the people who fought in them. I simply mean this expression to shock people into the reality that World War II, by and large, was won by the Soviet Union.
Yes.
Because, again, the scale of operations of the military campaign in the Soviet Union made everything else quite literally a sideshow.
Mm.
This was a conflict, a military conflict to the death between the two major ground powers of that day. And we have no idea, and I think this to a certain extent is deliberate on the part of our own presentations of history, but we simply have no idea of the sheer scale of operations, nor the huge, enormous casualties that Nazi Germany inflicted on the Soviet Union. Now, the bad news is that after the collapse of the Soviet Union, eventually the Russians revealed the fact that their casualties might have been as much as double as previously thought.
Quite right, yes.
So we're now looking at casualty figures that may run as high as 60 to 75 million.
Yes. Yeah.
And that poses some nasty historical difficulties.
Indeed, indeed. And when we come back from the break, I think that you might be able to help us connect a few of those dots about why it was that being assigned a duty station of the Eastern Front was so undesirable. And I think for a lot of our folks from watching Hogan's Heroes, you know, they knew that that was not a promotion to be reassigned to the Eastern Front. But it wasn't just because of the weather. There were a lot of things happening, a lot of toys, the extensions of some of that research you spoke of earlier that were being utilized, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So, Dr. Farrell, if we can take just a short break.
Sure.
We'll be back in just a few moments with listening audience, and where we're about to go in the conversation, no one knows quite for sure, but I can promise you it will be fascinating. So we'll be back in just a
BBSRadio.com. If it's not mainstream, it could be here. Information and knowledge. Bringing humanity closer to truth.
And welcome back from our break, folks. You're listening to The Crimson Pill with your host, Antonin Fiore, on BBSRadio.com, station number 2. We are very privileged on The Crimson Pill today to be joined by our feature guest, Dr. Joseph Farrell. And we left off talking a little bit about the actual historical scope, the magnitude of man's inhumanity to man through the course of that conflict.
And we'd left off with some of the staggering statistics, which, as you mentioned, Dr. Farrell, that these numbers continue to evolve as some of the nations involved, Russia in particular, Eastern Bloc nations, continue to release a bit more about those statistics. But what I wonder, Dr. Farrell, is if you would help us to understand a bit more about how it came to pass. Well, what were the tactics involved? What was occurring that could have resulted in these enormous casualty statistics, civilians as well as military in Russia?
Oh, boy. That's the question that opens up Pandora's box, because this really is, from the standpoint of conventional military operations, a huge mystery. Because as tactically competent as the German army was, and incidentally still is, as tactically competent as it was, and then later in the war, as they were getting their newer, more advanced tank designs online and going much more to an army that was deploying almost nothing but automatic weapons and so on and so forth, as tactically competent as this made the German army, it still means you have to account for an almost 10-to-1 kill ratio, which is, you know, anybody who studies military operations, particularly of that period, will tell you is just impossible. Mm. So this means that whatever's going on the Eastern Front, there is something else that is going on beyond the normal operational uses of World War II. In other words, they're using weapons other than tanks, bombs, artillery shells, and automatic weapons.
Yes.
Now, there have always been persisting rumors, if you study the Eastern Front very carefully, there have always been persisting rumors that the Germans were indeed using some non-conventional weaponry that was the result of some of their research projects. Now, one of the things I report in Reich of the Black Sun and then again in SS Brotherhood of the Bell is that we know from the testimony of Nazi veterans themselves, people like SS Colonel Otto Skorzeny, that the Germans did use a World War II version of the fuel air bomb. Now, we have to stop and really understand the staggering nature of that claim, because a fuel-air bomb, the fuel-air bombs that the Germans tested and had actually available at the end of the war, were capable of delivering a punch, a blast area, similar to a tactical nuclear weapon. In other words, these weapons were enormous weapons, all right?
Okay.
I even record in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, a test of a 1944 fuel-air weapon by the Nazis that quite literally laid all the trees flat to a distance of 12 kilometers. In other words, these are huge, huge conventional bombs.
Oh my.
If you were to see one go off, they would almost look like a nuclear bomb. All right.
Mm.
Well, the Germans, according to Skorzeny, were using these things as early as December in 1941 in their assault on Moscow. And they were using them in rocket-propelled artillery batteries.
Mm.
Now, if you examine the type of rocket batteries the Germans were using at that time in the war, they were these six-barreled rocket launchers, usually of 11 inches caliber, that would fire rockets, you know, multiple rounds of rockets. So in other words, if you can imagine a battery of six of these things, each firing six rockets, then the effect of firing fuel-air bombs, you might as well say carpet bombing and tactical nukes in the same phrase.
Oh, my.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Oh, my. And this is 1941. So in other words, the Germans are willing to use these types of weapons against the Russians. And I think the explanation lies in the Nazi ideology, because, you know, as far as the Nazis were concerned, the Slavs were an inferior species. They were an inferior race. They weren't willing to use these weapons on the Western Allies until very late in the war, when they began to contemplate doing so as the military situation simply deteriorated. But there are reports, in other words, what I'm getting at is there are reports over and over and over from the Eastern Front, beginning in 1941. You hear them again in 1942, coupled with the siege of Sevastopol in the Crimea. You hear them again in 1943, coupled with the Battle of Kursk. You hear rumors of death rays being tested in 1944 as the front advances into Romania, and so on and so forth. In other words, the Nazis were using everything that they had available, and the Russians, for their part, were spending rivers of blood to push the Germans out and back.
Yes.
Now, the reason we've never heard, in my opinion, the question I always get asked is, why haven't we heard of this until now? Well, the reason why we didn't hear of it in the war, I think, was, number one, Stalin would have been loath to admit that he was facing an enemy that was using these types of weapons. The Red Army had a vast morale problem all throughout the war.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to admit publicly that, you know, we're facing an enemy that's using these types of weapons, that may have weakened Stalin's government to the point that it may have either been forced to surrender or to collapse. So, in other words, you know, we are looking at, I think, with the casualty figures of the Soviet Union being so astronomical. I mean, we're talking almost a tenth of the population that was lost in that conflict to the German war machine.
Oh, it
would not have been won without the Russians. If we look at all of this and couple this to the stories, I think that's the answer. I think the Germans are using some of these technologies that they've researched and brought to a certain pitch of development, that they're using these technologies on the Eastern Front, and that's why it is so very bloody.
Indeed. And in fact, I think that, you know, the implementation, the use of some of these technologies, these weapons, we now know, our listening audience, the scope and the scale of the horrific proportions, the damage, the death, the genocide, you know, being being undertaken systematically by the Nazi party and of course, Germany by extension.
Yes.
And yet at the same time, that some of these types of weapons that are, well, quasi-conventional in nature, I suppose, at the same time, they were investing quite heavily in time, resource, et cetera, in some physics that we don't even have available to us from speculation, except for the body of your work and such. And I think you'd referred to the Nazi Bell research. I wonder if you could tell us more
about that. Well, yeah, the Bell is kind of the main focus of my Nazi research, for a very simple reason. What we're dealing with, in my opinion, with the Bell story is we're dealing, first of all, with the real basis for the Nazi UFO legend, all right? The problem here is that with the Bell, unlike with stories of Hanabu and Vril and all of these fanciful flying saucers that you so often read about, with the Bell story, we're dealing with something very, very different. And this is the reason it's taken me 6 books, and I'm even planning, I'm writing a 7th one right now as we speak on all of this.
Wonderful.
Because this is a story that really emerged after German reunification. And it emerged in such a fashion that you could couple the project itself to known installations, to known personnel with particular physics interest that dovetails quite nicely with this interwar unified field theory research that we mentioned in the previous segment, and dovetails quite nicely to one major physicist, a fellow by the name of Professor Dr. Walter Gerlach, who was an internationally renowned physicist. He was part of the Stern-Gerlach team, and Stern, of course, went on to win the Nobel Prize. So Gerlach is not a second stringer.
Mm-hmm.
But his own personal physics fascination was, number one, gravity, number two, magnetism and the idea of spin states of particles. He helped prove the spin state of the electron in that experiment. So, in other words, this is the man who is fascinated with all of this stuff. Well, he just so happens to also be the project head of this Nazi Bell. The third thing that we have with the Bell story is we have a known set of code names for this project, and we also have indicators in the literature that I've reproduced in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, and more recently in a book of mine called Roswell and the Reich, that the the project itself was said to be Kriegsentscheidend. In other words, the German word here is war decisive.
War decisive.
War decisive. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, you have to understand the significance of that code name used in connection with this project, because this term is never used of the atom bomb.
Uh-huh.
In other words, the atom bomb to them is already sort of small potatoes. Okay. It's yeah, and that's scary enough, you know.
Indeed.
And you have to understand that when you say the atom bomb is small potatoes, they also saw, you know, very clearly, they also saw the theoretical possibility of the hydrogen bomb. Well, they've already looked beyond that even, and are, with this project, are investigating torsion physics and its uses as being a way to tap into those three uses for zero-point energy, for field propulsion, and then, of course, for the ultimate weapon. You know, Nazis being Nazis, they want to weaponize it.
Naturally.
So people ask me, well, what's torsion physics? Torsion is simply a mathematical construct that emerges in some of these early unified field theories, that if you take a soda can and empty the soda out of it and wring it like a dish rag in your hands, all right,
mm-hmm.
that can represent space-time. Pardon me?
So twisting the top and the bottom of the can in opposite directions, then?
Twisting the top and the bottom of the can in opposite directions, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's what torsion does to the fabric of space-time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the reason I think that this is what the Nazis are investigating with the bell is on the inside of this device, and I get into lengthy explanations of what is reported about the device, and then sort of from on the basis of what's reported, try to back-engineer it in my books. In other words, back-engineer the possible construction and back-engineer the physics behind it. It is known for a fact that inside this device they had two counter-rotating cylinders rotating in opposite directions. In my opinion, these, while we are not told their arrangement, in other words, we're not told if they were one inside the other or if they were one on top of the other. In my opinion, they were probably one on top of the other, because this would precisely give you a torsion effect, all right?
I see.
So in other words, they are examining all avenues that they can to get to a physics that will allow them to have control over anti-gravity, the nature of the physical medium itself, and therefore to give them also the ultimate doomsday weapon.
Oh my.
And here's the bad news, Antonin.
Oh boy.
Yeah, this project goes completely missing at the end of World War II, along with the general in charge of it. Okay. And you know, this Nazi general is kind of like Martin Bormann. You know the story about Martin Bormann. Martin Bormann dies over here in a tank, or, oh, wait a minute, maybe it was over here at the train station. And,
yes.
Well, yeah, this SS general that was in charge of the Bell, he managed to do what even Bormann didn't do. He dies no less than four times under different circumstances on two different days, okay?
He sounds like he made a Democratic voter in Chicago.
Yes. Well, yeah, you're getting the picture here. You're getting the picture.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
Which general is this?
This is SS General Hans Kammler, Obergruppenführer Hans Kammler, which would be the equivalent of a four-star general. He, in my opinion, goes completely missing at the end of the war. Now, this is the real mystery here, Antonin, as to where the Bell ends up. The man who uncovered the Bell story originally was not me. It's a Polish researcher, a colleague of mine by the name of Igor Witkowski, all right, who published all of this story in Polish beginning in the early 1990s, right after German reunification. It was subsequently published in English. It was popularized, of course, by excuse me, by the British journalist Nick Cook, who works for Jane's Defense Weekly, all right?
Ah.
And Nick Cook, of course, published his book, The Hunt for Zero Point. And both of these men concluded that the Bell most likely, along with its scientists, came to this country, all right? Now, I take a very, very different line based on some things that were going on in Argentina, that most likely the project itself went to Argentina and continued to be investigated covertly by the Nazis themselves in Latin America. Mm-hmm. And I go into a lengthy project that was actually being sponsored by President Juan Perón's government in Argentina, and then it was shut down under circumstances that can only be called dubious. And at that point, the Nazi scientist that was in charge of Perón's project, he's placed under house arrest, and the project, so we're told, completely is shut down, but in my opinion, it's moved elsewhere. So the Bell Project, in my opinion, remained in Nazi hands. Some of the scientists went to Latin America. Some of them ended up in this country in working for NASA, you know, and that's a story that I get into in the books and in a big way in Roswell and the Reich. So, yeah, this is a huge story. There's no getting around it, and that's why I've written so many books about it, because you can't tell the story in one book.
There is a lot of real estate to cover. That there's no question.
Oh, yes,
and
absolutely.
I wonder if we could maybe take this approach for the next just couple of minutes, by way of somewhat you know, recapping or summarizing the ground that we've already covered. If I could ask you just a few questions, because I'm really so pleased with the BBSRadio.com listening audience, a very conscious, awakened, aware group of people, and I know that they oftentimes engage with these interviews in a true method or approach of a student, and they're taking notes and they're going to pursue threads of research.
Okay.
Could you tell us once again the German word or the term that was ascribed to this Bell research? I think you said it was war decisive. How is that in German again?
It's the German word is Kriegsentscheidend. K R I E G S E-N-D, pardon me, E-N-T-S-C-H-E-I-D-E-N-D, Kriegsentscheidend.
Wonderful, thank you. And I believe you said that this was the only program that was regarded or held at that level of urgency or importance. Is that right?
That's correct.
Even superseding their research into the atomic bomb.
Yes, that's correct. And incidentally, I want to set some context here.
Sure.
The first book in my Nazi series, Reich of the Black Sun, is an overview of my argument that the Nazis may have actually been successful in achieving the atom bomb. Now, I know that's a whopper that is contrary to all of the standard histories, but the really interesting thing here, Antonin, is that after German reunification, when all of the installations in the former eastern zone of Germany, some of which even the Soviets did not go into because they had simply been booby-trapped and blown up by the SS. Well, with the German reunification, the whole story of the atomic bomb is quite literally being rewritten as we speak. Largely by German and Polish and Czech researchers who've been able to piece together a truly astonishing story. But at the minimum, we are looking at a large and very successful German uranium isotope enrichment project on the scale, if not exceeding, the scale of the Manhattan Project. So at the minimum, they were extraordinarily close to the atom bomb, if not successful.
And I believe in your research, you point to at least one example of potentially or possibly when and where
may
have been tested.
Yes, I do. In Reich of the Black Sun, just to sum it up in a nutshell, in my opinion, they may have tested a small fission bomb on or near the island of Rügen in the Black Sea sometime between October 10th and October 12th of 1944. And the reason I say that, or the reason I maintain that, is there is a document that I refer to that was declassified only in 1992, just in the waning days of the first Bush administration before President Clinton's administration took office. The document is an affidavit of a German test pilot who records seeing or witnessing this test. And you have to read his description of what it is he's witnessing, because what he is describing in detail, and in detail that was not at that time known very well, is the detonation of a nuclear bomb. There's no other way to describe this other than as the detonation of a nuclear bomb.
Some of the telltale characteristics.
And the you know, I go into to many other contextual arguments that seem to corroborate that something happened during that time frame.
Mm-hmm. And I think perhaps this is another connecting point, because you know, quite a few folks in our audience are aware of, for example, Operation Paperclip, wherein some of those key scientists were brought here to the U.S.
and, yes,
and went on to hold, you know, essential positions and have gained, you know, worldwide recognition and prominence for their work. Probably the most prominent would be Wernher von Braun and our space program, of course. But there were a number of others, and probably quite a few that we never really even heard the name openly or publicly. But the work they did, that doesn't diminish the importance or the significance of the research that they had been involved in.
No, it doesn't. The you know, I get into that aspect of the story in Roswell and the Reich, because it is a crucial and in my opinion woefully neglected aspect of that whole episode by the ufology community. But if in essence, what you had with the paperclip scientists, particularly in the space program, is quite literally, in my opinion, a penetration by a Nazi cell into key and crucial areas of the post-war U.S. military-industrial complex. And it was so successful, and I'm not the one who first pointed this out. This has been pointed out by other researchers, mainstream researchers, who, even having pointed it out, I don't think really understand the significance of what they've just said. But these Nazis in the space program effectively reduplicated the very command structure, the very chain of command that they had working for Adolf Hitler in Nazi Germany at Peenemünde. You find the same people in the same position doing the same jobs. And this isn't just merely after the war. This is all the way up through the Apollo program. Mm.
Interesting.
So in other words, you know, you have not only that, Antonin, but you have a dirty, dirty deal that was made between Alan Dulles and the German general in charge of German military intelligence on the Eastern Front at the end of the war that basically turned over this large Nazi military intelligence network to the ostensible control of the post-war American intelligence community, which later becomes the CIA. Mm-hmm. But its day-to-day operational control remains in German hands under the same German general that commanded it during the war.
Quite fascinating, no?
Well, what's happening is, effectively, you've just made the CIA, you've just compromised its civilian charter.
Yes.
As soon as the ink is dry on the law that brings it into existence. And the other thing you've done is you've effectively made the operational Soviet desk of the CIA a front for nothing but Nazi spies.
Ah, yes, yes. And you
know, so in other words, you know, for those people who've always been maintaining that there's a rogue element within American intelligence, well, I would offer the opinion that this is the historical basis of it.
Quite right, quite right. And in my mind's eye, I can hear some of our listeners in their cognitive dissonance right now saying, that's just not possible. That's enough.
Of course.
I've had enough. That's not possible. And yet, I would ask you to open a fresh browser on your computer and do a Google search for the Gehlen Organization. G-E-H-L-E-N, I believe, is the spelling.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
The Galen organization, and you'll rapidly come across some information that will help ease your cognitive dissonance and be prepared for the connecting elements of this thread, because in my view, the real estate that we've already had a chance to cover here in the conversation, and in particular, your to me, I believe it's much stronger than just a theory. It's not speculation on your part that that the Germans had actually attained a very advanced position in their understanding with their atomic weapons program and research. As a matter of fact, that might quite possibly have been one of the important bargaining chips, I believe, for the folks that made the deal with the devil, so to speak, at the end of the war. I hope I'm not throwing too much out there on the plate, but
that's more or less the line I take in my books, particularly in the Nazi International. I speculate on a scenario that this atomic bomb technology and the secrets that went with it were indeed a bargaining chip that was used to broker some of these other deals for post-war Nazi survival and collusion with elements of the American military-industrial complex. That's precisely what I'm getting at here. But, you know, again, putting it into the context of what I'm arguing in the books, the technology and the physics represented by the Bell, in my opinion, and again, I lay out the argument in much more detail in the Nazi International, but in my opinion, that technology they kept to themselves. In other words, they kept the really cool stuff to themselves.
The war decisive
and were
stuff.
giving us and the Soviets basically a roughly equal division of the spoils to kind of set up the long-term circumstances for the Cold War. So, you know, this they planned this post-war strategic evacuation with a great deal of finesse.
Yes, and also, I believe, with a sizable war chest to work from.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, there a former associate of the CBS journalist, Ed Murrow, who was, of course, the Walter Cronkite before Walter Cronkite, an associate of his by the name of Paul Manning wrote a book that, when I read this, it floored me, because the book was called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. And he reports that and the reason he wrote his book was basically because, as a journalist, he was incensed at the way that journalists had treated his associate, Ladislaus Fargo, who, of course, wrote Martin Bormann, The Fourth Reich, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And Fargo reproduced all sorts of documents from the Argentinian Central de Inteligencia, their central intelligence, that basically maintained that Bormann was alive, well, and under sort of the protective surveillance of the Argentine government.
Mm.
Well, Paul Manning dug a little further into the story and published his book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, and he came to the stunning conclusion that Bormann and Perón controlled approximately $800 million.
Oh my.
That's 1945 dollars, folks.
Oh my.
Just in Argentina alone.
Oh my goodness.
And the real shocker, and this is kind of where I pick up with my scenario of post-war collusion between this Nazi International and the Anglo-American corporate banking elite. All right. Think Bilderbergers here.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Because Martin Bormann, according to Manning's research, actually sometime in the early 1960s cashed a check for, I think, something like $2 million, something like that, cashed a check over his own signature drawn from Chase Manhattan and manufacturers Hanover Banks.
Oh, my.
And it was cleared through Deutsche Bank in Buenos Aires. Ha, 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 ha. Ha, 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 ha.
Oh my.
Yeah. Mm. So, you know, I write in a book of mine called Babylon's Banksters, if you look at the real founding intention and purposes for the Bilderbergers, I think the hidden intention, since you have Prince Bernhard, a former SS officer, who therefore would be in the chain of command of any post-war Nazi organization.
Oh yes, yes.
And a good friend of theirs by the name of Dr. Hermann Josef Ops, who turns out to have been the CEO of Deutsche Bank during this period, During the war, he was working for a small handling bank in Berlin, but this small handling bank in Berlin was actually the bank that handled the payment of salaries to government officials. In other words, this Dr. Hermann Josef Ops was the guy that was paying Adolf Hitler his salary as Reichschancellor. I think with the Bilderbergers, what you have as a secret purpose is meetings to coordinate this vast movement of Nazi loot into Western banks, and then to launder it back into Europe as the means for the post-war reconstruction of Europe. So in other words, you have even in the European Union, you have a very long-term, very hidden, very deeply buried Nazi influence in the creation of this post-war circumstance and geopolitical arrangement.
Yes. And I'm thinking that as we near our next break here, perhaps to set the stage for the conversation to follow, and just in case some of our listening audience is still experiencing a bit of that cognitive dissonance.
Cosmic dissonance, yeah.
I think that a way of helping to understand some of the possible scope and magnitude of the presence that was established largely through creation of corporations within a range of different types of industries. But Martin Bormann was quite a Donald Trump of his day. He had a mind, it seems, for making money and expanding their grasp. And it, just as, again, just before we finish here up before this next break, it's my belief that Alan Dulles and I think our Justice Department, our system went into work following the war to try to close down, to shut down as many of those corporations that had been founded by Martin Bormann, during and prior. And yet, of course, the extent of our reach could not make it into different parts of the world. Nothing we couldn't touch in Russia or China or different parts of the globe as well. But, Dr. Farrell, do you have a sense of that scope of just how many corporations we did shut down or learn of and close?
The actual U.S. Treasury reports say that there were approximately 750 corporate fronts that were found and discovered largely by American Treasury investigators after the war and that were shut down. All right? This, in my opinion, if you read the Nazi International, this, in my opinion, was the tip of the iceberg. The reason why is that Bormann himself had not only his own considerable financial genius, but, again, he was closely connected with Dr. Hermann Josef Ops and another very prominent figure in Nazi finance, and that's Dr. Hjalmar Schacht, all right? These men, I think, were very successful in creating a kind of a smokescreen operation as well for the Allies to follow. In other words, I think this is more or less what the Allies found was what they wanted to be found.
I see.
And, the proof of the pudding here is the fact that they were not able to get their hands on nearly $1 billion in the hands of Juan Perón. That was in Argentina. And again, that's just one country in Latin America. You have several others. Now, I think in all likelihood, what really happened, the other alternative explanation for this story is that, this was a cover story that, these funds were confiscated. But I think really that was kind of a cover story to move this money into those Western banks, in short, to launder it. But the reason I say that is if you're dealing with a post-war Nazi organization with basically German military intelligence left intact after the war under the same Nazi general commanding it, and that organization is in turn plugged into the other little Nazi cells all over Europe and South America and so on, If you're dealing with an organization like that, then they do have a bargaining chip to sit down at a table behind closed doors with those Western bankers and say, okay, now look, Mr. Rockefeller, we're giving you all this money you can put on your books, or rather, give you can keep off of your books, expand your ledger credit entry making ability, and give you quite a reserve here.
Mm-hmm.
But know this, that if you don't keep your end of the bargain, we can find you.
Oh, my. Mm-hmm.
In other words, when you're dealing with Martin Bormann, you're dealing with Dick Cheney without the warmth and charm.
Now, that's truly chilling to contemplate.
Yeah, that's truly chilling to contemplate. In other words, you are quite literally entering into an agreement not only with a kind of mafia godfather figure, you're dealing with a real organization with long, long reach.
Oh, boy.
And you'd better be keeping all the I's and T's dotted and crossed just so. Because if any party to that agreement breaks it, rest assured there will be consequences.
Oh my, and it certainly sounds like they had the toys by way of their research programs to make good on those
Bingo.
Sorts of threats.
Bingo.
Yeah.
This Dr. Antonin, Farrell? I think, is one of the hidden covert things that's happening in the world right now.
Oh yes. Dr. Farrell, I do apologize, but we do need to take another short break here
sure.
in the show. And what a fascinating and interesting stage I think that we've set for where we'll turn our conversation to next. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Crimson Pill radio program with your host Antonin Fiori, and our distinguished guest today, Dr. Joseph Farrell, and his body of work. Join us in just a few moments, and we'll continue our conversation. Welcome back to The Crimson Pill, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Antonin Fiori. We're joined today, our featured guest is Dr. Joseph Farrell, an academic, a researcher, a lecturer, and an author whose range of work is breathtaking, quite frankly. And in today's conversation, we've been focused on the body of his work that pertains to the Nazi International, some of the research, as well as some of the ideology, really, behind the Nazi party, its effect, of course, in obvious ways on world history. Dr. Farrell, before we continue this last thread of our conversation, one thing that I'd like to make sure that we have a chance to talk a bit about is what's the best way for folks to make their way to your body of work? Myself, I think I have a copy of all but your most recent book, and I surely encourage our listening audience to start building their library as well. It's just every page is loaded with well-researched and carefully considered information. What's the best way for folks to find out more about your current work and what you have available?
Well, actually, they can go to my website. It's www.GizaDeathStar, that's G-I-Z-A, and then the words Death Star. .com. That's all lowercase, all one word, no space or anything. And I do have a web store on the website, so they can get all my books there. That would be the easiest way. If they don't like doing that online, then Barnes and Noble or Borders or any of those stores usually carry my books. If they don't, they're perfectly willing to special order them. But they can get them off my website.
Certainly. Fantastic. And I think I would add another kind of layer to that as well. Dr. Farrell's website is, in my feeling, very wonderfully done in that you can access a range of topics that Dr. Farrell has commented on, some almost a white paper type level, as well as more in-depth information about any of the books, about the threads of his research. And Dr. Farrell, I'm really impressed by the quality of the interaction that some of the other folks who follow your work. I'm on one of the email mailing lists where you're just kind of continually giving the world a heads up about some essential topics that are happening all around us, and having done so quite well again from your your style, which is, I think, such a reasoned voice in a field of sometimes eccentricity. Any other thoughts about your website, maybe some new feature or anything that I have neglected to mention here?
No, there, like you say, there's. I have white papers on there. I have a members-only area, which is accessed by subscription, and I do video chats with people on that are members of the website, and basically those are kind of freewheeling affairs where people just ask me questions and I respond. It's kind of a more of an interactive thing than your typical interview or things like that. And like you say, I post white papers there on various subjects. I'm working on a couple right now that I had planned to get done earlier this week, but you know this sort of business, the plans oftentimes get left by the wayside, but I am working on a couple more white papers where I go a little bit more in depth and technical detail than I do in my blogging or in my books. They're kind of intended to fill in the background of some of the science and technology on some of these things and some of the history as well. But
certainly,
that would just kind of be too obscure to put in a book.
Certainly, certainly. Well, I hope that here in our remaining time, I'm going to warn the listening audience up front. We cannot begin to do justice to the body of Dr. Farrell's work. And in this entire conversation, we've only been focused on just one subset of his work. And even in this, if we had spent 10 hours, I don't think we could have covered all the real estate. Would that be fair to say?
Well, yeah, I think so, unfortunately. It's a big story, like I say, and that's why I've written 6 books on it so far, and I'm writing a 7th. You know?
So,
yeah, it's a huge, huge field, and I really don't think that even now, that given all the things that are being published in Europe about all this, particularly in Germany and Poland, I just, you know, we're still playing catch up in this country with what's being researched in Europe.
Quite right. And if we think about the ground that we have covered thus far in the conversation, we've talked about how during the era of Nazi Germany, around 1910, leading on forward, there were a tremendous number of brilliant scientists in and about Germany itself. And many of them have become common names, you know, the Plancks, the Bohrs, etc. And yet some, I think they were just as brilliant, just as gifted, and yet their talents probably went under the radar quite largely by way of, hey, today's favorite words for our U.S. leadership to use, national security.
Yes.
All the most important stuff is kept quiet, is not brought to the public eye. In fact, Donald Rumsfeld, in September of 2001, had talked about how $2.3 trillion were not trackable, not traceable. And a lot of that points toward the scale of investment that are made in operations that are considered classified and or black operations.
Right.
How about if we pick up from there? Can you talk with us more about the implications, the impact, and ramifications of someone like Martin Bormann with $800 million to play with in Argentina alone? What could that turn into?
Yeah, this is really the crucial question here, because if, you know, we make two assumptions in answering this question. The first assumption is there was a post-war Nazi international, a Nazi extraterritorial state, if you will, that had sufficient funding, sufficient organization, and sufficient personnel to continue its research into secret weapons, into black projects and technologies and so on. And the second assumption is that this organization could still be in existence. Now, if you make those two assumptions, then the picture becomes very dark, because that amount of money, obviously, in this amount of time, 60-some years since the end of World War II, would have grown considerably through careful investment.
Oh, my.
And with, you know, with enough money and manpower, in other words, to use the favorite expression, the sky would be the limit, quite literally. You would conceivably have, with this organization, quite literally a breakaway civilization, to use the ufologist Richard Dolan's expression and thesis. You know, this idea that black projects in this country created effectively a breakaway civilization with its own sort of culture, with its own sort of agenda, that is kind of a parasite living off of its host. Well, the idea, I think, has an earlier historical basis. In other words, I think this idea arises in Nazi Germany because, again, the history of the Nazi Party comes out of occult movements, secret societies, and so on, that midwife it into existence. So you already have a kind of a breakaway mentality. It takes over a major world power and runs that world power for 12 years and then essentially goes back underground. So you have you have all the rudiments there for Richard Dolan's breakaway civilization. You have the rudiments of the technology. You have the rudiments of the finance. You have a bureaucratic structure. You have an intelligence organ attached to it. In other words, you've got all the makings for a breakaway society.
Indeed.
So, yeah, the geopolitical picture then changes dramatically because you're not only dealing with standard post-war geopolitical conflicts between the East and the West, between the United States, Russia, China, you know, the various European powers. You're not dealing anymore with simply geopolitics in that classical sense. You're also dealing with new entries on the field, international corporations, you know, all the things that we are aware of.
Yes.
But then hidden underneath the scenes, you're dealing in almost every major power. You're dealing with effectively breakaway civilizations researching these black projects, certainly in this country, certainly in Russia. You've got this phenomenon. You're dealing with international criminal syndicates. And then finally, you're dealing with the horrendous possibility that there may be an international fascist organization with their hands on some really cool toys.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, oh, my. You know, that's not a pretty picture.
Right.
That's not a pretty picture.
Now, I can imagine that some folks at this point, once again, our old friend cognitive dissonance coming into play, I imagine some folks are wondering, now, wait. If any of this were possible, how could it have been pulled off? I mean, we militarily defeated Germany. They surrendered. It's on paper, right? Well, I think you might be able to provide an interesting twist, another way to think of that. And then also I wonder if you can start from that point and walk us through some of that logistic about how this Nazi international could have gone underground in a logistical way.
Well, the first problem is the surrender. I actually begin the Nazi International by looking at the two German surrender instruments and a comparison of those surrenders with the Japanese surrender, all right? Because it's very, very interesting. If you read the German surrenders of May 7th and 8th, one was signed at Reims, France, and the other in Berlin the next day. In both cases, you have no representative signing in behalf of the Reich government.
Oh.
What you have are military delegations, particularly in the case of the Berlin surrender. You have Field Marshal Keitel, Luftwaffe General Stumpf, I believe it was, and then Admiral von Friedeburg for the German Navy. At the Reims surrender, it was Colonel General Jodl. So, in other words, at the surrenders, you have the representatives of the three German service branches surrendering. You have no one signing these surrenders on behalf of the Reich government. You have no one sitting down saying, the Third Reich, the government of the Third Reich hereby surrenders to the Allies, or some equivalent statement. Now, this is significant because in the Japanese surrender, you do have it made very clear that the surrender is being signed on behalf of the emperor, the imperial diet, the imperial general staff. You know, basically everybody that needs to be surrendering is surrendering. Okay. In the case of the Third Reich, however, no, it's just the German military. There's no representative, in other words, of the Reich government. And what is really significant to me, Antonin, is that the Allies had representatives of the Nazi Party in their hands. They could have easily demanded that those representatives sit down, sign a surrender instrument abolishing the Nazi Party and declaring it to be a criminal organization or some such thing.
Mm-hmm.
None of this takes place.
None
of this takes place.
And
from the standpoint of law, this surrender appears to me to be rather dodgy. And the interesting thing is there are codicils in the Berlin surrender that indicate that, well, you know, we'll tack other codicils onto this as we think of them to be signed at a later date.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the problem is, who are you going to get to sign on behalf of the Third Reich? Exactly. So, you know, this from the standpoint of international law is a huge, huge problem. You know, it sounds kind of picky, but in the context of an emerging post-war deal, especially nasty, dirty little deals being negotiated between members of American intelligence and members of Nazi intelligence, this omission takes on a rather different and more sinister significance. And it raises your other question very directly. How does this Nazi organization work logistically? Well, it has to work logistically at some level, in collusion with one or the other of the post-war powers. In other words, it has to be existing with the connivance of either the Soviet Union or the United States or both.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you see, that's the real rub. The other way that it works logistically is, you know, you can compartmentalize research and manage or farm out your requirements for parts, you know, order this part from this firm and this part, other part from that firm, and no one really knows what all of this is for, and all you really need to do is assemble it. That's the way it works in American black projects, and I strongly suspect that this is the way that they made it work after the end of the war, particularly with what they were doing in Argentina. There's definite evidence that they're using German firms that supplied parts during the war, after the war, and supplying the same sorts of equipment. And what the German firms can't supply, you know, they can get American firms to do. So in other words, this is a very tightly organized, well-oiled machine.
Indeed. And I think there's another interesting twist, I believe, with Argentina and nearing the conclusion of the war. I'm not sure if your mind is already going to the twist I'm thinking of, but maybe talk to us about a bit about that.
Well, you know, the really interesting thing, you know, I've studied World War II since I was a kid, and even as a kid I wondered, you know, why in the name of sense does Juan Perón declare war on Nazi Germany in March of 1945, 2 months before the end of the war? And the reason that always puzzled the daylights out of me is that Juan Perón loved the Nazis. He just thought they were wonderful. In fact, there's a picture of Colonel Juan Perón traveling in Adolf Hitler's entourage after the fall of France in Paris in 1940.
Interesting.
Okay, in other words, Perón was very, very tightly connected not only to Mussolini's Italy but to Hitler's Germany. And had been and visited and traveled and gone on joint military exercises with them. So, in other words, Perón is the quintessential Nazi file. So when he becomes president of Argentina, you know, it always puzzled me, what in the name of sense is he doing declaring war on Nazi Germany? And then you add to this fact, the standard historical response is, well, Perón was pressured to do so by the United States, all right? And there they leave the matter. So in other words, if you're an American history student, you will never, ever be told the story, nor will it ever occur to you to investigate further. Well, if you read Perón's memoirs, what he himself says is something to the effect, well, we hadn't lost control of Germany simply by our declaration of war. On the contrary, it worked to Germany's benefit. Why? Because under international law, as a belligerent, it gave Argentina the right to enter Germany with its planes and ships. And then Perón goes on to say, and that's how a great many were able to come to Argentina.
Aha.
Aha. So in other words, Argentina, as an ally of the United States, France, Great Britain, and the Soviet Union, went right in there, picked up a bunch of Nazis, and flew them back to Buenos Aires and served them cocktails and peanuts on the way.
Indeed.
Now, indeed. You know, talk about a slick trick.
Yes, yes, indeed.
And indeed. I strongly suspect, Antonin, that that isn't really even the end of the story, because I strongly suspect that certain elements in the United States wanted that to happen. In other words, that this may have been the hidden reason that this country pressured him to do that. And he was all too ready to do so because it suited his purposes as well, and it suited the Nazis' purposes because it gave them a nice base of operations in a technologically advanced country that had enough of an industrial base to accomplish what they wanted to accomplish, and that was to continue their research.
Endlessly fascinating, no?
Yes, it is.
And I know that some folks would probably kind of puzzle and wonder, boy, would that be enough? Argentina's very late entree into the war. Now, I think it's pretty clear it wasn't just because they wanted to have their name on the winning team, but
right.
For you, as you had mentioned, some very logistical and tactical considerations in mind for that maneuver on their part. But that
Absolutely.
Probably wasn't the only mechanism of transfer, so to speak, for the Nazi International to go underground. There's also a body of work out there readily accessible for folks, starting with the Odessa files and that
oh, yes.
chain of information
yeah.
about how, once again, possibly the logistics occurred to move this infrastructure of people, of resources, and of toys
yeah.
to the Southern Hemisphere.
Well, there's the technology and resource transfer, Antonin, was huge. There were black U-boats conducting these operations months after the end of the war. You can dig and scratch long enough, and I haven't even written about this in my book or any of my books, but another researcher named Henry Stevens has just came out with a book. You know, the secret U-boat bases in the Canary Islands were part of this operation, as was Franco's nationalist Spain. You have an enormous amount of transference of wealth and personnel, but here is the key component that most people are missing. Not only of wealth and personnel, but of patents, of blueprints, and of scientists and technicians to South
oh,
America.
My.
This is the key part of the story.
Mm.
And lest we forget, this also had immediate post-war political repercussions because you find these same Nazis setting up these ratline operations involved ostensibly at the behest of the CIA in the overthrow of King Farouk in Egypt and the installation of Gamal Abdel Nasser. All right, why is that so significant? Well, it's of major significance right now, because we're witnessing the recent departure of Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. Well, Hosni Mubarak was simply the continuation of that Egyptian government that the Nazis helped bring into power back in the 1950s with the overthrow of King Farouk.
Oh.
So in other words, this organization had major political influence after the war. It was involved in some notorious activity, and we're still living with the consequences of it.
Oh, my.
Oh, my.
How complicated the web is weaved, I think.
Oh, yes, yes. And you must remember something else and something also equally frightening. It was during World War II and continuing after World War II that you had contact between these Nazis and this organization and radical Islam.
Hmm.
Ah.
Nothing like
it was
opening a great big can of worms in the last few minutes available to us.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
this,
having opened
this is a huge story.
A couple thoughts there.
Pardon me?
Having opened that can, though, a couple thoughts there.
Well, one of the things I talk about in the Nazi International is that one of the activities that it became involved as a covert hidden sponsor in was international terrorism. You find, if you research the history of terrorism, you'll run into the fact that in late 1970s, there was a so-called terrorist summit that occurred in nationalist Spain. This was when General Franco was still alive. That occurred in nationalist Spain. What you won't often discover is that the sponsors of that terrorist summit, which included Muammar Gaddafi and then Yasser Arafat and so on and so forth, was one SS Colonel Otto Skorzeny.
Mm.
And incidentally, it was Skorzeny who helped overthrow King Farouk, who helped Gamal Abdel Nasser train Egyptian intelligence, who brought in a bunch of Nazis to help do this. So in other words, you're dealing with a very, very powerful organization that has been involved in recent events and that has connections with contemporary things. So in other words, you know, we have to at least admit, for the sake of argument, for the sake of possibility, that much of what we're being told concerning contemporary events may not be the complete truth.
Of course, we don't have the time to fully explore, you know, that set of real estate, but
right.
In the interest of teasing and provoking the listening audience, would you maybe feel like making mention of at least one example?
Of a contemporary event that may have other explanations?
Possibly, yes, yeah. In this case, we're just setting the stage, hopefully, for a future conversation where we can pick up that thread and run, but... So if you'd rather kind of keep everyone in suspense, that's fine as well.
Well, I don't know, because the problem here is I have lots of speculations and thoughts, but I normally like to speculate after I've written a book where I can lay out arguments more completely. But
sure, naturally. And point in fact, that is the singular reason I have such esteem, respect, and regard for your work is precisely that. There are so many folks in you know, pursuing the threads of research today that they're willing to range far afield in speculation, you know, almost from the beginning. And I've always very much appreciated the disciplined approach that you bring, Dr. Farrell, and that you, well, to put it into, you know, kind of average parlance, you like to have your ducks in a row before you really start to talk
right.
a lot about the ducks.
Well, you know, it's not to say that I don't speculate. I do, you know. But you
it's
know,
a considered
and some
though,
of it, some of it's very wild speculation. I'll grant you, but at least I try and argue it. I do think that there is something going on right now in today's world that smacks of a kind of covert war. I'm kind of the opinion, Antonin, and I don't want to get too deeply into this, but I'm kind of the opinion that the Anglo-American banking corporate elite is on the defensive, and that to a certain extent they are showing the signs of panic. I think that they are under some real severe pressure. I think that a gun was put to their head, I'll just say, within, let's say, the last 12 years.
Okay.
And that when they didn't comply, the trigger was pulled. And I think that if you look at certain events a certain way, you can speculate on the possibility that we're looking at a real honest-to-God covert war taking place right in front of our eyes. But it doesn't look like that because, let's put it this way, Mother Nature provides the perfect plausible deniability.
Ah, yes. Yes. Anyone in the listening audience that is adept at reading between the lines, I think your eyebrows just raised. At least I hope that they did. And Dr. Farrell, unfortunately, that really brings us here to about the end of the time that we have available on this program. And, sir, it has really been a distinct honor for me to have you join the Crimson Pill and speak on the body of your work and research. And I sincerely hope that we can have a chance sometime soon to pick up the thread of this conversation and move it forward.
Sure. It's been my pleasure, and I'll be glad to be back.
Well, I appreciate that. And your closing thoughts, Dr. Farrell, here on today's program. I hope once again you'll tell folks how they can most quickly come to get closer to your research, your website, and any other closing thoughts that you have.
Well, no. If they want to look into my books or order my books, the best way to do that is just go to my website, which is www.GizaDeathStar.com, and that's spelled GizaDeathStar.com. And there is a web store there that has all my books. If they want to order them off of there. But yeah, I think in terms of what we've discussed, I think that you really, in order to understand what's going on right now, you have to kind of have a historical background. And my own opinion is that at least part of that background, I'm not saying by any stretch of the imagination all of it by any means, but at least part of that background is provided by the peculiar circumstances of the end of World War II and the most likely survival of Nazism as an ideology and as an organizational research structure. I think that's the real frightening potential here.
Indeed. And in my heart, always one to be the provocateur, I'll provide one or two more teasers to the listening audience. Folks, do a search. Look up Operation High Jump. Learn a little bit about Admiral Byrd and some of his comments on the matter. Do a search for the name Smedley Butler, a distinguished and highly decorated member of the U.S. Armed Services, and he had some thoughts and observations by the time he retired, perhaps was retired from his work. A lot of other fascinating things. Dr. Farrell, I wish we had 20 hours today alone, because I still don't think we could have made it through all the real estate. But sir, thank you again so very much for your time
and
helping us become familiar with the subject.
All right. Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you. Thank you, and take care, and hope hopefully we can touch base and rejoin our conversation soon.
Sure.
Very good. Well, folks, you've been listening to The Crimson Pill. I am your host, Antonin Fiore. We were joined today by Dr. Joseph Farrell. It was a distinct pleasure and honor to have him with the program with his expertise and the work that he's done. At this time, we'll sign off for today. Please keep in mind that the show is available in the program archives on bbsradio.com, station number 2. We look forward to having you back with us again next week. We'll pick up our threads of research with Dr. Stanley Monteith and explore some of his work and observations in his career. And again, very much we appreciate having you with us and having your open mind available as we explore some of these subjects that are just so amazing, so fascinating, and at times so chilling. Once again, thank you so much. Antonin Fiore signing out. We'll see you next week.